The CO2 from this event is in the atmosphere for 100, 200 years, roughly. Keep these projectors on, the lights on. So we are changing the climate tonight. Whatever else we may do, we are changing the climate as we sit here now using fossil fuels to do this talk. 2050 targets, therefore, are irrelevant. It doesn't matter about what happens in 2050. It's about what happens today, what happens tomorrow. Really, what happened in the past as well, but we can't do much about that. So it's about the build-up of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases. And that's really important. What matters are the cumulative emissions, the build-up of emissions day in, day out. That's what's important for climate change. Not some long-term mythical target that's got nothing to do with science or climate change that keeps us all happy. So we have to move back towards cumulative emissions, carbon budgets. But that rewrites the chronology. It rewrites the timeline of climate change. It takes it away from wind turbines in 2030 or nuclear power, carbon capture and storage, other great schemes way off in the future. That these things are no longer adequate. What it tells you is you've got to do something immediately, urgent and radical reductions. You've got to come off the curve now. And you can't come off the curve with supply technologies, not quickly enough. Now, I won't be quite explicit here. I'm not saying the supply side is not important, but it cannot get you off the curve anywhere near fast enough. So you'll have much higher temperatures if we just rely on people like me, engineers, to come up with technologies that will solve the problem in 2025 or 2030. Remember, it's not just coming up with the technology, it's getting that technology to penetrate the energy system. And that can take decades. So it's not just having the good idea, it's making the good idea actually work. So how does this scientifically credible way of thinking of 2 degrees C, this idea of carbon budgets, how does that reframe the whole debate? Well, firstly, let's look at the latest data. It's not quite the latest data, and we can plot this for next year. It'll be worse next year, and it'll be worse the year after. So we all know this. And actually, this curve could be for anything to do with humans, really.
For the first time in 7 years, I have to ask for your help. I've always paid the whole cost of Radio EcoShock out of my pocket. Now my income has gone down while production and distribution costs are going up. You can help this radio program keep going by clicking on the donate button on our website at ecoshock.org or on the blog at ecoshock.info. My thanks to the listeners who have made that donation this past week. Radio EcoShock is the second biggest environment show anywhere. We run the world's largest free green audio download site. Become part of the program, won't you? Anderson says scientists have been keeping quiet about the tendency, one could even say plot, to underplay everything about the looming climate catastrophe.
The growth rate in CO2 for the last century was 2.7% per year. On average, it was 2.7%. Now, remember, that's a...
And sorry, we're going to interrupt Kevin Anderson speaking to the Cabinet Institute on Climate Change because it's 9:31, and we need to get on to the next part of Political Perspectives, Part 2. You can hear that entire program of Radio EcoShock on radioecoshock.com. And again, that was British scientist Kevin Anderson speaking to the Cabinet Institute on Climate Change. And next, host Chris Andre speaks with Dow Orion about her new book, Beyond the War on Invasive Species, A Permaculture Approach to Ecosystem Restoration.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Coming right up, you may have noticed that Air Cascadia is a half hour early, and that is because we have a special program today and a very special guest. We're going to be speaking with Dow Orion. This half hour, we are right now, it is 9:33 a.m., and we will be speaking with Dow for half an hour. Then at the top of the hour at 10, when you are least expecting it, or perhaps most expecting it, we will open the phone lines and take calls from listeners. If you've been listening to the half hour coming up right now, I'm sure that you will have questions, because this is a novel, revolutionary approach two invasive species. The book we're talking about, of course, is Beyond the War on Invasive Species, A Permaculture Approach to Ecosystem Restoration. The author, Dow O'Brien, is sitting right opposite me, and we welcome Dow to the KBOO Airwaves. Thanks for coming in today. This book, there's a foreword by David Holmgren, who, of course, is one of the key founders of the whole permaculture movement and the whole notion, the whole approach to growing food and in and growing communities as well. I think that we can safely say that pretty much anything is an ecosystem. We're in an a radio station is an ecosystem. We're in an ecosystem right now. The niche that we are in would be the air room. That's how it works. And thinking in these terms makes it easier for us to connect with some of the complex systems that we have created and now must contend with. So a little bit first about our guest today. Tao is a permaculture designer, a teacher, a homesteader, and a mother. And she lives in the Southern Willamette Valley, teaches permaculture design at Oregon State University and at Aprovecho, which is an extraordinary place. It's a 40-acre, nonprofit, sustainable living educational organization, and it is absolutely stunningly beautiful. Thoroughly succession, thoroughly integrated into time and space. It's an excellent example of what happens when one is very sensitive to the idea of stacking, something we will probably get into a little bit later in the conversation. Tao consults on holistic farm, forest, and restoration planning through the Resilience Permaculture Design. She holds a degree in agroecology and sustainable agriculture from UC Santa Cruz. And I want to ask you again about how you got in interested in the act of restoration, what got you involved in this. And we'll get into all of that in just a moment. But welcome again to the KBOO Airwaves. We're so glad to have you here. I also, before we start in with questions, is just to let you know, we will mention this again throughout the program in case you missed it, and I'll post links to this information on the KBOO website. You can also get the information by calling the front desk. There's a celebration of the publication of this book, Beyond the War on Invasive Species, as well as ABC Darien Insectarium, which is very beautiful illustrated alphabet of insects by Lynn Massey. So we'll have more on that. That's going to be at the First Unitarian Church. Most people know where that is. It's at 1226 Southwest 7th Street. That's on July 23rd from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. You can hear the authors speak. There will be a book signing and organic hors d'oeuvres and teas will be served. So it was something well worth coming out for. If you are interested in not just permaculture, not just invasive species, what they are and how we live with them or without them, as the case may be. If you have any of these concerns, if community building is something that you are involved with, then this is a great opportunity to find out more about a gentle way of living on the planet. And more people need to be aware that that is an alternative approach. So without further ado, thanks again. How did you first get involved in this?
Well, hi, thanks for having me. A few years ago, I got a job as a botanist working for a county restoration project. And I became aware of how extensive the concept of invasive species as bad or as negative actors in an ecosystem was. And it really ran against a lot of my training in whole systems analysis as a permaculture designer, because from my perspective, I really see invasive species as having a role and a niche and filling a niche in an ecosystem. So seeing especially the extent of herbicide use in restoration really piqued my interest in researching this issue more deeply. because I felt like there can and should be a more holistic alternative offered when it comes to their management.
What's your definition of permaculture?
Oh, permaculture is a design system based on the function and patterning of natural ecosystems that meets the needs of humans and all the other creatures that we are interdependent with.
Well, you just said a word that is is extremely important to me and to what I do on my farm, and that is pattern. Pattern recognition drives everything that I do. And I'm pretty sure that management of invasive species involves the application of pattern recognition in many different environments. How do you apply that concept to your work?
Well, the more I looked at it, and I looked at all kinds of different species that are considered invasive all throughout the world, and the patterns that I started to see was that they exist in ecosystems that have been changed. And in certain ways, they appear as symptoms of ecological degradation or significant changes in management and the way that we manage and interact with ecosystems. So looking at that pattern really showed me how when we take a step back and kind of look at the bigger picture of what's going on in an ecosystem, we can really start to see what role invasive species are filling, what roles, and that pattern language can help us kind of develop a new way to approach how we want to interact and manage them using ecological principles as a guide.
Right, yeah. So we do tend to think of our environment and what grows there, both plants and animals, as good if it benefits human beings as a species, and bad if it benefits other species or it benefits itself in an integral way. Oh, we've just been John Schramsky wrote a piece recently. He's an engineer working out of Georgia State University in Athens. He has written a paper on thermodynamics and the extinction of the human species, because apparently the way that the destruction of plants on the planet is rapidly changing the basic what systems which are governed by basic laws of thermodynamics. These are laws which I can't get a good lawyer to get you out of it, basically. these laws are not like ours. They are more or less permanent factors. Wanted to also ask you, what do you see as the difference between farming, agriculture, and gardening? I like to think of what I do as growing things. Uh-huh. Because I have an issue with agriculture. It causes people. People are frequently the cause of some of our problems. So how do you see farming, agriculture, and gardening?
Well, to me, agriculture, the way that we think about it, which is mostly based on annual cultivation of the soil, has led to many of the major environmental problems that we're facing today, including climate change. There's more carbon released from soil tillage than there is from all fossil fuel combustion taking place on the planet. So rethinking that approach to growing food is a big part of my life and my research. And so I like to think of what I do as gardening and farming. I do grow food on a larger scale. At my homestead, we probably grow 50 to 60% of our own food, not just vegetables, but staple crops as well, as animal products. So, to me, there's a spectrum of cultivation activities that people have been engaged in on one level or another for thousands of years. And one of my interests in researching this book and kind of prior to coming into this decision to write this book was ethnobotany and looking more into how historic indigenous communities have managed land in ways that we wouldn't really think of as agriculture, because it's not annual tillage, but it is sophisticated ecosystem management through directing succession towards more advanced successional ecological characteristics using perennial crops. So that's something that I think that we should be researching very intensively right now as we, you know, look toward changing the agricultural systems.
Yeah, succession is a term that, if you are involved in permaculture, it's a very familiar term. But there are different succession works in ways that can be extremely beneficial. We seem to have, in some cases, when with tillage and with these massive monocultures, succession has been virtually eliminated from the picture. This has a very, very, I think, destructive effect on the land itself. How do you see succession? How can we nurture succession so it's beneficial to the environment and to not just to us, but to the environment as it is seen from a holistic perspective?
Well, it's kind of interesting with agriculture and tillage, especially if you think about it as a disturbance in an ecosystem where you're clearing the soil, succession and the process of ecological regeneration is going to happen in that ecosystem, whether you want to farm there or not. And so the weeds that come in, whether it's amaranth or Canada thistle or, you know, whatever it may be, are bringing that ecosystem along on its successional trajectory. And as farmers, we work with that to, you know, favor our crop plants. And, you know, this is a much longer and more in-depth conversation about how to manage succession. But briefly, from a more permaculture-based perspective, what we're looking at is enhancing that process towards yields in an ecosystem that we can make use of. So moving an ecosystem along in its trajectory towards advanced successional characteristics, meaning longer lived perennial food crops, not just food for us, but food for other creatures as well. So for example, preparing the ground for chestnut and walnut trees to survive and thrive, where eventually over the course of 20 years, we may be able to meet our carbohydrate needs from our property using chestnuts rather than consistently having to till the ground to grow wheat. That would be an example.
Yeah, we do tend to think of invasive species or invasive species in terms of succession and the space that they take up and life cycles and so forth. But you think about the problems in terms of time as well. When and we use the word, you know, invasive species in a cautious way, when it arrived, where it arrived from, what the trajectory is, because if living systems do seem to follow the bell curve to a certain degree, how does this fit into, how does the idea of an invasive species fit into the timescape as well as the landscape?
Well, a lot of the more recent research on succession in ecosystems has shown that there is no specific endpoint that any ecosystem is tending towards, even though a lot of models in the past have been like, succession is linear and predictable. For example, we can say we know that this is what the ecosystem is supposed to look like, you know, in 400 years. But a lot of more recent research has shown that that's not true. And in fact, ecosystems are responding to feedback on multiple scales. And so when we see invasive species come into the picture, it appears that it might be arresting succession, or when in fact it's changing its trajectory. But that's the nature of change on the planet, and that's what's been happening for billions of years. And invasion is a natural process of the way ecosystems change and have changed over the course of, you know, geological time.
So there so. Is, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, go for it.
The invasive species then is kind of a response to changing conditions in the environment. And when we talk about, there are pressures from climate collapse that cause us to respond by sometimes bringing in another species that we could use, we think, to control an agriculture situation that we don't like BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, that has been used so extensively that how do we beginning to have to think about soil itself. It's a living thing. It could be an invasive species. No. Mm-hmm. Animals too. How all of these different systems are integrated, and how they interact, and how they generate unpredictable results. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about? I have markers all through this book, hundreds of them, and a lot of it has to do with questions of predictability. I think that one reason that people seem to be terrified and have launched this war on invasive species is fear of losing predictability or losing control. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always said that myself that a managed forest is a tree farm. How do you think of the predictability and manageability of our environment and the species, invasive or not, that we share it with?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one of the things that we're dealing with now, as everybody probably knows at this point, is climate change. And we've had the opportunity as a civilizations, you know, throughout the world over the past 10,000 years to have a relatively stable climate, which has led to ecosystems of a certain sort and a certain composition. Now, things are changing. And, for example, there's a recent study out of Oregon State University that showed that the invasive Himalayan blackberry in controlled laboratory conditions with elevated carbon dioxide concentrations grew four times more quickly than the native rubus species. So in a way, we're selecting for Himalayan blackberry by increasing carbon dioxide saturation in the atmosphere. And, you know, as much as we want to cut it back or spray it, if the CO2 concentrations continue to rise, which they most likely will, I hope that they don't, but we're going to be seeing species like that becoming more and more prevalent. So, you know, we have to have some measure of reality when it comes to understanding these species and how they're interacting with the current ecosystem. We're not going back. We can't go back.
So, thinking again about invasive species and how they fit into time as well as space, to what degree are we able to predict now that you have to factor in, as you said, climate change into the whole equation? Is it even possible to make predictions anymore? I mean, what about what we call invasive species becoming resistant to every possible herbicide? And is that a good thing or bad thing? Maybe we do need our house covered with kudzu vines. I don't know.
There's some research about climate modeling and what different ecosystems could look like given a 4°, 6°C rise in temperature that we're looking at, you know, over the next 50 to 100 years. And some of the best models that I've seen have shown that, you know, you can predict certain elements of how different species of plants and animals are going to be able to move and migrate. Up to half of ecosystems, at least in Western states, from one study that I looked at, are unknown and unpredictable entirely, meaning we don't know what's going to be able to survive there given the way that rainfall is going to change, snowmelt, snowfall, drought conditions, elevated temperature, how all of those factors are going to intersect to create ecosystems of the future. Even our best scientists are unable to say that at this point.
Yeah. It's way too many factors, way too many variables, I would mm-hmm. imagine. That leads me straight to what you said to what I wanted to ask you next, which would be, what's the difference between, does it make a difference where the invasive species comes from? And maybe it's invasive there. How far back do we have to trace this? And does it matter whether it was as a human intervention, whether people brought it, whether it found its way here? Is it invasive if it got here by itself? Mm. We imagine it got here. Of course, we changed conditions, so it did get here. But how does that affect the way these species fit into?
Well, it's complicated. There was a recent study that came out just before I finished writing the book that was looking at the origin place of different invasive species and, you know, where they ended up. And they found that most invasive species are, or at least invasive species that come to North America, or, well, let me back up a little bit. Most invasive species are coming from Europe and Asia. And most places that are prone to invasion are North America, Australia, New Zealand. To some extent, what they found in the study, that this has to do with the age and the maturity or the development of ecological relationships in those places of origin. So the invasive species, when they were in their place of origin, they had a lot of ecological interactions there, and they came to a place where there weren't as many robust ecological interactions. But other research has also shown that those ecological interactions will develop over time, and they do. These species aren't existing in a vacuum. They are existing in an ecosystem, and the fact that they're surviving and thriving now doesn't mean that they're going to be doing that forever, because there's always forces acting on all of us to adapt and change, die. You know, it's inevitable. Evolution's inevitable, whether you're an invasive species or not.
I love it. This is the most amazing book. It is not simple. It is absolutely fascinating. Once you start it, I found that my plan was I would go straight through to the end and then catch up on the notes. I read it in pieces. I read it in almost a circular way. Starting with the myth of wilderness and ending up considering, with everything in between, of course, I hope, if use appropriate technology. And I suppose this would include herbicides, this would include alternatives to tillage, which tillage is is a desperately unfortunate technology. We're almost out of time here, so I'm going to maybe save that question for the next part of the show. We have three minutes left in this part. Do you want to wrap that up first before we do the top of the hour and then take some questions from listeners?
Sure. Could you repeat the question?
Just a quick wrap up before we take questions.
Yeah, I think one of my main points in writing this as a person who is an organic farmer by training and a permaculture designer is looking at invasive species in terms of the ecosystem that supports them rather than the species themselves, because they're telling us something by their presence. And if we desire to change the conditions that are allowing them to proliferate, then we need to work on addressing the root causes of those changing conditions, not by addressing the symptoms by eradicating them. It's not going to do anything over the long term. it may look good for a period of a couple of years, but if we're not, you know, getting to the root of it, we're not really working on any deep level.
And yeah, I want to, in the next 15 minutes that we have left, talk about pioneer species as well, because that's one of the most important key features of the issue of invasive species as a whole. We do live in a world of invasive species. Pretty much everything now could easily be considered an invasive species, us preeminently. Of course, you are listening to KBOO Portland. Today is Wednesday, July 22nd. It is 9:59 a.m. My guest, of course, is with us on the issue of invasive species. Tao Orion has written an incredible book, Beyond the War on Invasive Species, a Permaculture Approach to Ecosystem Restoration. We'll talk more about restoration, about pioneer species, and about being good stewards of the earth that we share with all species. So moving right into the next section, if you've been listening and you're curious, and any of this has piqued your curiosity about what we mean by invasive species and permaculture and appropriate technologies, this is a good time to call us at 503-231-8187. That is 503-231-8187. Call us with your questions right now for our guest today, Tao Orion, who has this amazing, extraordinary book, Beyond the War on Invasive Species. It is it will open your mind to what is right in front of us all the time. This is, I guess, what we mean by pattern recognition, is seeing the world instead of looking at the world. Mm-hmm.